Okay, good evening and warm welcome to everyone. Thank you so much to Necham and Lauren Sampson for once again sponsoring our Tuesday night series. We greatly appreciate your support. Well, in this series, we're going to be touching on matters of culture and politics just a little. The purpose of this series is really not to delve too deeply into political commentary, but rather to explore our Jewish values and what we can learn from our tradition about the issues of the day. And many have written about how in recent years we've seen the declining level of discourse in our society, the culture of social media and sensational headlines are meant to draw attention but often lack nuance. And there is an unsettling coarseness and incivility in our national political debates that we all know, which has also seeped into our community conversations, whether it's at the Kiddush, at the Shabbat table, at work, or wherever it might be. And with the attack on civility and mutual respect, the purpose of this series, and I'm so glad that you're here to learn together, is to really highlight our tradition, our Jewish ethics, to help guide us and to help strengthen us and help us navigate the culture wars. One survey that I found in my research by the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression identified over 500 incidents in which scholars at colleges and universities were targeted between 2015 and 2022 for things that they said or wrote in the past. I didn't find any surveys about rabbis in terms of things that they've said in the past, but at least for scholars at colleges and universities. Another survey of almost 1,500 professors at colleges and universities across the country revealed that half are, quote, worried about losing their jobs or reputation because someone misunderstands something they have said or done, takes it out of context, or posts something from their past online. What about students? So a survey of college students in 2022 reveals that almost 3 out of every 5 students are reluctant to talk about a significant controversial topic for fear of generating negative social media or negative social reaction or retribution from other students. And so they're nervous about what's come to be called cancel culture. And cancel culture is the term. It started becoming popular over the last number of years. And I think most of you are familiar with it. It's the phenomenon in which a person is canceled, shunned, fired, or boycotted because of something he or she may have said or done in the past. It could be something recently, it could be something 5 years ago or 50 years ago. A celebrity or public figure or anyone said something offensive, and critics, often through social media, will publicize what the person said or wrote, perhaps recently, or again, it could be a long time ago, and persuade people that this is sufficient grounds to deem this person as unworthy, as deserving of social isolation, and should be canceled. That's it. It's finished. And this affects not only celebrities. Consider the example of Kyle Kashuv, which I actually put here on the source sheet as your first source. That's a picture there. It's a little bit hard to see. And the title of the article is that Harvard rescinds the offer to the Parkland survivor, Kyle Kashuv, after discovery of racist comments. And this is written about by Rabbi Benjamin Blech. That's how I actually came across it, where he writes how, well, first he tells us about Kyle Kashuv, a son of Israeli immigrants, survivor of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, in which a gunman killed, I think it was 17 people in the massacre. And the event was a transformative moment for Kyle, who resolved at that point to become a positive force for change. He applied to Harvard, and he was accepted to Harvard. However, soon after, a former classmate alerted the admissions committee of texts in which Kyle wrote racial slurs. Now, I don't know if that former classmate was upset because he didn't get into Harvard, or whatever the reason was, or maybe because Kyle beat him out for valedictorian, salutatorian, whatever it was. But the former classmate alerted the Harvard admissions committee of these texts in which Kyle wrote these racial slurs. So after Harvard inquired from Kyle, they inquired from Kyle about the matter. Kyle wrote a letter. He recognized that it was totally wrong what he wrote. He expressed and clarified how it was written to just, you know, privately to high school students when he was 16 years old, a few years earlier. But he sincerely apologized. And he wrote that really since the Parkland shooting, that he's a changed person, he's totally different, and he's ready for Harvard. And needless to say, despite the apology, Harvard rescinded the admission. And that's what it says here on the sheet. His acceptance was rescinded after Harvard discovered that he used racial slurs in texts. So one way to put it is that Kyle Kashuv was canceled by Harvard. Now, supporters of Harvard's response and those institutions and organizations that take a similar stand to Harvard, and the supporters of Harvard and their decision, will say that, look, it's necessary to take these stands. It holds people accountable. It gives disenfranchised people a voice. And you know what? It makes people more sensitive and caring in what they say, what they do, and you know that we have to be very, very caring with our words. And we all agree that racial slurs are wrong and they should have no place in our society. Detractors of cancel culture argue, what about forgiveness? What, is this person going to be condemned for life? What about the idea that this kid, he was a high school student, and part of the idea is that we're supposed to grow and develop as an individual? What do Jewish sources teach us? So one source, you don't have it on the page, but it's a well-known Mishnah in Pirkei Avot towards the beginning. It says, Dan et kol ha'adam lekaf zchut, that you should judge every single person and give her or him the benefit of the doubt. Why does it say Dan et kol ha'adam? So perhaps one of the commentaries that you have to judge the entirety of the person. You have to understand, you know, where they might be coming from and their background. And it's very hard to really understand the entirety of the person, but that's why we give a person the benefit of the doubt, because you have to understand the entirety of the individual and also the context of the statement. And that's very, very important. And a lot of times things are taken out of context. And you take a statement and it's out of context, and then the person is shunned and deemed unworthy. And that's not fair sometimes. Our tradition, of course, also recognizes the capacity of teshuvah. Mara Brachos relates the famous story. This is one of my favorite stories about how Rabbi Gamliel, sadly, you know, he was a little bit out of touch, and he embarrassed Rabbi Yehoshua when he found out that Rabbi Yehoshua disagreed with him about a matter relating to the topic of Mariv. And he forced Rabbi Yehoshua to stand on a chair the entirety of the lecture. Right? I try to take care of you guys, right? I let you sit, relax, we have food. And he had also embarrassed Rabbi Yeshua and other students in the past. He had a hardline approach, Rabbi Gamliel. He had a very strict admissions policy, the Gemara says. And he humiliated Rabbi Yeshua at least a couple of times. And the students finally said enough, and they decided to dismiss Rabbi Gamliel to no longer be the head of the yeshiva. Long story short, after Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed, and you remember Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I have to go, what did I have to do first? I have to ask my wife whether I should take the position. And the second question is, wait a second, they're not going to respect me because I'm a young guy, I'm 18 years old. And that's the famous account of how he became gray prematurely. And so he gained a little bit of respect from the students in the yeshiva. But long story short is, after he was dismissed, he recognized that what he did was wrong and that he was out of touch. And he was brought to one of the homes of the yeshiva students, and he saw there was black on the walls, and he said, whoa, these are the conditions in which you're living. And they said, you don't realize the conditions and you don't realize what we're going through as students. And he apologized for the way he treated the students and the way he embarrassed Rabbi Yeshua. And after he apologized and he recognized what he did was wrong, so the Gemara says that he was brought back to be the co-Rosh HaYeshiva together with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and they would rotate weeks about who would give the shir, who would give the drasha. And so what you see from here is that he was forgiven, and he was given a second chance, like the Jewish people are given a second chance after the Chet Egel, and that this is the concept and the capacity and responsibility of Teshuvah, the great gift of Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur, when we're able to do tshuva and to start again. And you might say that in today's climate, what might have happened to Rabbi Gamliel? He might have been canceled. That's it. He can no longer have a position in any yeshiva. And that's it. He's out. Look at what he does. Look at what he says. And so that's one of the points in terms of what Jewish sources teach us, is that, of course, a person has to be sensitive in what he or she says about others. There is accountability for our words and our actions. But at the same time, danes kol adam lekafzot. And there is a capacity for teshuvah, forgiveness, and also growth. In this case of Kyle Kashuv, he was 16, then it was a number of years later when he applied to Harvard. A lot of times it happens when it's something that a person said 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, which is significant. I'm not saying we disregard it, but in Judaism, we highlight the notion that life is a process, and that we all have to grow and develop over the course of our lives. Human beings make mistakes. To err is human. The key is, do you learn from those mistakes and do you grow from them? Now, some things are so egregious, and there's consequences. There are mistakes, and then there are mistakes. But if we're talking about an offensive comment, and of course, as every situation is different, people grow in the way they speak and their kindness and their recognition of the sensitivities of people. And we'll talk about that over the course of the series in terms of the sensitivity we need to have for where other people are coming from and the empathy we need to have. But this notion of growth, I came across this fascinating source a number of years ago about a real-life case that occurred in Israel. Some years ago, there was a young man who was dating a girl, and they were thinking about getting engaged. And the father of the girl, so you know the joke about the guy who comes in, and the father says, how are you going to make a living? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to help. And you're not going to go to school? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to go to help. How are you going to afford for the kids? When you have kids in Mirtz Hashem, you're going to have a family? He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to help. Hashem is going to help. And so when the father comes in, and the wife says, so what do you think about the young man who's taking out our daughter? The husband says, wow, it's amazing. He thinks that I'm HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But in this real life story that I'm about to quote to you, it's a little bit of a strange story. The father of the girl insisted that the prospective chatan give him a sample of his handwriting so that the father could submit it for evaluation, for analysis. And this is the controversial area of science known as graphology, I believe, where they study the handwriting to discover the character of the person. Now, the young man was very uncomfortable, but nevertheless, he acquiesced and he submitted a handwriting, a sampling of his handwriting. It was evaluated, it was deemed to be okay, and they got engaged. But then the chatan admits to his rabbi, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, a rabbi in Israel, that since he was so nervous, he hadn't submitted his own handwriting. He had gone to one of the fine, sweet boys in the yeshiva who had won the Midos Award, and he had somehow taken a sheet of paper with his handwriting and he submitted it as if it was his own. So at least the question is, he now obligated to tell his prospective father-in-law that he had fooled him? Now, you may say it was wrong for the father-in-law to ask for it, but once he was submitting it, certainly we'll agree that it was wrong to lie. So, but now that the deed was done, must he confess that he faked the test? So Rav Zilberstein writes that the chatan, of course, should not have deceived his father-in-law. He shouldn't have done that. But he's not obligated to tell him that he faked the handwriting. Why? Because he says the handwriting of a person even if you say that it does show something, it only shows the innate human propensities or qualities of the person. But the fact that we have certain instincts or qualities, or we have a nature, that doesn't show who we are, because we have the capacity and the responsibility to shape our personality and to refine and to cultivate our character and to grow over the course of our lives. So the handwriting, if there's any basis to it, it might reveal the innate character, and the picture might give clues, but it's really all in our hands. And so the handwriting doesn't say anything about who this young man is today. And I think it's an incredible, it's kind of like a wacky, you know, a funky type of story. But I think the message is very, very strong, which is that, you know, there's a debate, is it, you know, nature or nurture? And both nature is important and nurture is crucial, but there's also a third component, which is bechira chavshit, which is every single person has the free will to make choices, to make decisions, and to grow with nature and nurture and making difficult choices and taking actions that shape our personality. That's how we become our best selves. So with these three different elements, really I think Judaism has highlights for us, again, without getting political. We're not sending out, you know, throwing out labels, but you have, number one, the importance of giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. Number two is the notion, of course, of forgiveness to Rabbi Gamliel and to others. That's part of our tradition. And number three, which is that the human being is not a static personality, and that it's not just what we've accomplished, but what direction we're heading in, and that a person has to continue to grow over the course of her or his life. So the fact that you said something or did something 5 years ago or 10 years ago is significant, but you may very well be, and hopefully you are, if it was something wrong, hopefully you are a changed person and you learn from that and you're a different person today. Now there's a whole other, and that's one of the problematic things with, you know, cancel culture, which I think to me is, and it's, the term is used, I think, generally in a negative sense. And again, there are some positive elements to it in terms of accountability and sensitivity we need to have, but very often with the simplistic canceling of somebody, it's maybe not considering and taking into account those three different elements that we just mentioned. Benefit of the doubt, forgiveness, and growth. Now there's a whole other second dimension here, which is that, now look, if it's a racism, it's discrimination, it's sexual harassment, then the person should lose his job, should lose his position at the university, or whatever it might be, probably. And if it's things that are egregious, certain things are obviously wrong and unacceptable, and there should be appropriate consequences, and so it's not like you could have two different opinions, you know, that there's a disagreement about something, you know, like you have choices. Is racism, you know, good or bad? No, racism is wrong, and it should have no place in our community. We're using just a light-hearted, just a cute story that may be true or may not be true, but just popped into my mind about, you know, on the El Al flight, where the flight attendant says, "Would you like dinner?" And you say, "You know, what's the choice?" She says, "Yes or no." So some things are just no choices about. It's yes or no. But we all know that very often in our society, there's many gray issues. There's issues that reasonable people, have different opinions on. And so for those things, there is a culture that we sometimes see of an absolute rejection of the other opinion without even listening to it. And here, I brought a few sources to highlight elements that all of you understand, but maybe touch on maybe different angles that perhaps are not always highlighted. Maybe they are highlighted, but worthy of review. Famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, "Kol machlokas shi l'shem shemayim, sofa l'hitkayim." Second source on your page. Every dispute that's for the sake of heaven will in the end endure. V'she'ena l'shem shemayim, eina sofa l'hitkayim. But one that's not for the sake of heaven will not endure. What's an example of a machloket for the sake of heaven? That's the controversy of Hillel versus Shammai. what's a controversy that's not for the sake of heaven? So that's the controversy of Machloket Korach v'chol adato, that's Korach and all his followers. And there's two interesting elements about this Mishnah, at least, that I want to highlight. That in the first clause, you notice that the antagonists are both mentioned. It's Hillel and Shammai. And in the second half of the Mishnah, it says that what's an example of Machloket, a debate or a controversy that's not for the sake of heaven, that's Korach and his followers. So it's not congruent. It should have said Hillel and Shammai, Korach and Moshe, or Korach and his followers and Moshe and Aaron. So why doesn't it say the other side? Moreover, what does it mean that an argument for the sake of heaven will endure? I thought the idea is that we're supposed to try to resolve arguments so that they don't endure, so they don't linger. So I wanted to share three ideas about Korach, kind of connected to this Mishnah. That when people argue about an issue, and you know we get into arguments, one approach is that of Korach, where the goal is to absolutely nullify the other side. There has to be a winner and a loser, and of course, we have to be the winners. And therefore, there's no mention of Moshe. Why? Because in Korach, this is the story in Bamidbar, as you may be familiar. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the story, even if you don't remember all the details, it's fine. But it's where Korach basically challenges the authority of Aaron and Moshe. And there's no mention of Moshe because it was all about the selfish interests of Korach and his followers. So that's why it says Korach and his followers, because they didn't care one iota about what Moshe and Aaron had to say. They just wanted to present their argument. They were not interested in a dialogue. The other way to argue or disagree is like who? Is like Hillel and Shammai. The Gemara says in source number 3, Erevin Yigimel Amadeis, it says, since both these and these are the words of the living God, Gemara says that Hillel and Shammai and the Academy of Hillel and the Academy of Shammai, they both academies had wisdom and intelligence and tradition. And both of them are the words of the living God. Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim, which is a very, very interesting, provocative statement. But so then why? Why does the halacha typically follow the position of Hillel? And the Gemara answers, Mibnei shenochen v'aluvenheim, v'shonim divreim v'divre beit Shammai, v'lo od ala shemakdim v'divre beit Shammai l'divreihem. The Gemara says something amazing, that it's not necessarily that they were wiser, and it wasn't necessarily that their arguments were more compelling. Well, then maybe at the end they were more compelling because of their approach. But what was it? That they were nochen v'aluvin, they were pleasant and easygoing and forgiving, which is interesting. But also, they would quote the position of Shammai before proposing their own position. And they made sure to quote both positions. So this is the approach of recognizing that people have different perspectives. And it's not about nullifying the other, but about understanding the other. And since it's about understanding the other, that's why it's, as opposed to Korach and his followers, who are just about themselves, that's why it's Hillel and Shammai. That's why it's the two of them, because they're recognizing that you have a real person who you're debating with, who could very well have a legitimate opinion that you could learn from. And there may be truth that you could remember and incorporate for later on. There could even be a synthesis between the two views. One idea that I like sharing with the Chatan and Kala is, you know, that the mezuzah, right? When you walk into a room, you have a mezuzah on the doorpost. One opinion actually says that the mezuzah should be vertical. Another opinion says it should be horizontal. And a common practice is to put it the diagonal. And that's the Ramah says, that the reason why you put it diagonal is because it's a compromise between the two positions. So every time you walk into a shul, or every time you walk into your home, and certainly for Shalom Bayit, you see the message of the mezuzah, which is that Hashem is watching over us, and of course our faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our commitment to build a Jewish home. But beyond that, the importance of compromise, to have Shalom Bayit, to have harmony in the home. And so that's why both the positions of Hillel and Shammai endure. That's why it mentions Hillel and Shammai. And for that reason also, it says, Sofo lehitkayim, that argument's going to endure. Because both positions have value. They're incorporating the truths of both. And for that reason, the debate endures in, of course, a positive and constructive fashion. And that was the spirit of the debates that Hillel and Shammai had, which was listening to the other side and recognizing the truth, perhaps that they could learn from the other, which is a little more, it's rare in this day and age to say, oh, and we're in, you know, going into a debating season among candidates. If you have candidates on the stage, national television, and one candidate proposes, says something, an argument, if you imagine the other candidate says, oh, that's really interesting. I never thought of it in that way. I want to think about that a little bit. Forget about it. That's it. Candidacy over. But from Jewish metrics, that shows his greatness. If he's willing to consider the truth of somebody else's position and try to incorporate it. And so this was the spirit of the debate between Hillel and Shammai. Although Hillel distinguished himself even above and beyond, even more than Shammai, as the Gemara says, and that's why the halacha follows Hillel. The second here element, again, of this second dimension. Okay, the first dimension was, you know, in terms of giving the benefit of the doubt and forgiveness and the idea of growth, the handwriting. But this whole other dimension of the discussion is, how do we debate? How do we argue? How do we have respectful disagreement or not? And so the first thing is the distinction between Hillel and Shammai versus Korach. Second interesting element about Korach is with Datan and Aviram. Datan and Aviram, these were nasty fellows. Moshe never got along with Datan and Aviram. And so Datan and Aviram were involved in the rebellion of Korach and 250 other people. And when Moshe says, you have it on your source sheet, in source number 4, when Moshe invites them to a peace summit to try to make shalom, they say, Lo na'le, we will not come. We're not interested in meeting you. And that level of chutzpah is like astonishing. And you have to wonder, what led to that disrespectful response from Datan and Aviram? Yeah, they were nasty, nasty fellows, but to not meet with the leader, to not meet with Moshe. So the Ger Rebbe, the Sfas Emes, offers the suggestion that Moshe, of course, Moshe, the greatest prophet that ever lived, and so whenever we speak about Moshe with great reverence, but the Ger Rebbe suggests that he made a mistake, Moshe did, in the invitation, that he sent an agent to deliver the message, when perhaps Moshe should have gone himself to speak directly to Datan and Aviram. The Pasuk says, Vayishlach, he sent an agent. Without getting to particulars, you could ask questions on the pshat, but that there's a very relevant message for us, which is the value in general of direct personal communication. And then once you insert any sort of intermediary, in Moshe's case, it's a messenger. And in our world, it's electronic media. When you have these intermediaries and you're not interacting, so then it opens the door for all kinds of things to happen that would never happen with direct communication. And that's what leads sometimes to the hurtful words and the misunderstandings. And there's many things that just texts are inadequate for and emails are inadequate for. And certainly social media, you know, when somebody posts something or says something and then responds. So when there's no interaction that's taking place and personal direct communication that's taking place, but it's just kind of labeling or you know, denigrating about what somebody may or may not have said, so then it often doesn't work out well. This is a general comment that we often develop stereotypes and ideas about people that we don't interact with ever. And the more social interactions that we have with others, that really breaks the stereotypes. And it leads to better communication and understanding of one another. And so the interactions can be productive when it's done with the spirit of listening, and with the idea of, okay, I want to personally connect with you and I want to hear what you have to say, as opposed to just being in an echo chamber and saying what I want to say. The third element of this story, it just quickly is that, you know that in the story, that first is the swallowing up of Korach and his followers with the earthquake. Then also there's a punishment of fire from heaven that comes and consumes and burns up the 250 people who were offering the incense. They were challenging Aaron. And you had some who were challenging the underground political leadership of Moshe. You had others who were challenging the Kohen Gadol, that Aaron was chosen as the Kohen Gadol. So maybe that's why the earthquake and the fire. But that doesn't convince the Jewish people. Then after that, you have a plague that kills thousands of people. But still, the people are not convinced that God chose Aaron to be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, or that Moshe and Aaron have their authority from Hashem, different layers of the story, but they weren't convinced about it. And finally, what's the last thing that takes place in the story? Is God has them place the staffs. Each tribe places the staff, and Aaron places his mateh, his staff. And in the morning, it's Aaron's staff that grows, that blossoms with almonds in a miraculous fashion, which testifies to the leadership and the authority of Aaron. Earthquake, fire, plague, they don't do it. But it's the blossoming staff of Aaron that finally convinces B'nai Yisrael. So I once heard from my Rebbe, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. He said that what you see here is that it's possible for a group to be vindicated without destroying or negating the opponent. And that, yes, God, in his wisdom, in his infinite wisdom, yes, these punishments were justified. The earthquake, the fire, the plague, they were justified. But ultimately, they don't convince the people. But it's the blossoming staff of Aaron that's the more in the positive for Aaron, as opposed to destroying the opponent. That's what actually wins the day and convinces the people. And so this is a very, very crucial idea, which is not just listening to the other and relating personally to that person as a human being, but also that you could win an argument without eviscerating and destroying the other. Right? We all like to win an argument. But you could win, you don't have to win every argument, number one. And number two, you could win the argument. If you have a strong argument, you win it by presenting your argument in a compelling fashion. Bring sources, show the logic, show the blossoming of your opinion without pushing down and destroying the other. Now, in an ideal world, wouldn't it be great if we would all agree and have the same opinion? Would that be the best? I mean, in the days of Mashiach, is it going to be that everyone is going to have a uniform position about X, Y, and Z? So after the flood, you have here in source number 5, you have the psukim there. The major sin of mankind after the flood, that generation, was the Migdal Bavel. It was a generation of the Tower of Bavel that was designed by Nimrod and the people of Shinar. And the Torah tells us, you have there in the first pasuk, everyone on earth had the same language and the same words, that the people of Shinar were of one language and of common purpose. And they said, let us build a city for ourselves to prevent us from being dispersed. Sounds wonderful. Right? They want to be unified. They speak the same language. But Hashem's all upset. Hashem comes down to look at the city. He says, look, they have one language and this is what they're doing. And Hashem punishes them by dispersing them and foiling their plans. What were they attempting to do? And what was their crime? And different positions are offered. Either they were maybe trying to escape the next flood, so they were building a tower. Maybe they were trying to wage war against God in space. It was the first space colony, putting a nuclear warhead in space, maybe to attack God. But the Netziv has a very interesting explanation of the Tali Tzuyuda Berlin, where he says that, no, they wanted to build a peaceful and united society, but the unity that they wanted to create was one of uniformity, of suppressing distinction, of making sure that everyone thought in the same exact way. Nimrod was the original strongman who was all about control and domination. And the purpose of the tower, according to the Netziv, was not to wage war on God, but it was to monitor everyone's whereabouts, to make sure nobody was escaping. And it was also to see what everyone was thinking and everyone was saying. They were patrolling the city to regulate intellectual thought. And they were the founders of the Big Brothers of history, you know, the prototypes of the communists who want to inhibit diversity. And that was the mistake. That was the sin. But why is that so dangerous? Because if you live in an echo chamber and your opinion is the only correct one and you want everyone to think alike, so then it leads to arrogance and also leads to flaws. And in that generation of Migdal Bavel, people were afraid to express their own opinions, and they were forced, there was a suppression of opinions. Ramosha Taragin called it the ultimate cancel culture. All divergent opinions were canceled. And so we grow from the perspectives of others, and the idea that people think differently is not a negative, but it's a positive. The Gemara says, Kishem Shepartzufam Shonot Deotam Shonot. Just like every single person looks unique, and you kind of like the fact that you look unique. You look marvelous, right? You look great. And you don't love when somebody says, oh, somebody looks like you. Okay, unless it's Brad Pitt, you know, or something like that. But usually, you know, you like having your distinct look. So just like a person likes to have their distinct look, the Gemara says, just like every single person looks unique, so too every person thinks in a unique fashion, which is an amazing thing. But that's the way of the world, and there's a positive to that. And just like you're happy that you have a unique look, so too you should be happy that and be comfortable and secure. If somebody else expresses a different opinion, the world's not going to come to an end, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would always emphasize, my Rebbe in Gush, Zatzal, would often emphasize that when thinking about other communities, you know, sometimes, let's say, when you think about the Haredi community, I don't want to say anything, but sometimes it's canceling done there too, right? Where, you know, we totally reject that philosophy. There's nothing that we could possibly learn from them. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, whenever he would speak, let's say, about comparing the Dati Lumi community with the Haredi community and similar kinds of comparisons, he would always say it in the way that they could learn from us and we could learn from them. It's a great way to look at it. I could learn from you, you could learn from me. It doesn't always have to be in that fashion, but certainly talking about, let's say, a religious Zionist community and a Dati Lumi community, yes, they could learn from our religious Zionist tolerant, a sense of openness, a Torah Mada vision. But we could learn from their total dedication to, and their meticulous dedication to Torah and mitzvos and tefillah and learning, and their commitment to preserving Jewish life and emphasis on family are elements that we could all learn from. We can disagree, but without denigrating, and we could grow from learning from one another. While the tower represents the idea of the attempt to bring uniformity to mankind, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik points out that the rainbow, the multicolored rainbow, symbolizes the diversity of mankind. And I'm not getting into politics and the symbol of the rainbow. It's just simply Rav Aaron Soloveitchik saying, not like there's anything wrong with that, you know, as the saying goes. But the beauty of life signified by the rainbow is when you have different colors. You have the different tribes of Israel, it's the 12 tribes of Israel, side by side, coming together. So this is not unity of uniformity, it's unity of diversity. And that's what the two key kind of symbols of Parshat Noach teach us. It's the Tower of Babel, which was uniformity, and then you have the rainbow, which is the diversity. And so really you need, it's not uniformity, it needs to be unity with diversity. So is cancel culture good or bad? So it's not a simple black and white question. It depends on how it's, you know, how it's being utilized and when it's being quoted, and every situation is different. I think the key lesson that we all know is that Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, that Derech Eretz, the way we respect one another, takes precedence to everything else. And many of us view Derech Eretz as a sort of like a, it's like an add-on, it's a supplement to the Torah personality. It's nothing more than a bit of polish on the exterior of an individual who is an observant Jew. It's good to have Derech Eretz. No, as I'll say that Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah, that if you're missing the basic understanding of proper behavior, of sensitivity, of forgiveness, of compassion, of giving people the benefit of the doubt, it's missing more than just polish. You're lacking in basic Torah character, and it nullifies all the achievements, because Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. And one line that I've said is that Frumkeit without Menschlichkeit is not Yiddishkeit. And at the core, one needs to be a mensch. So is it good or bad? Cancel culture, Jewish values. It's nuanced and it's complex. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein also said that when he was asked what did he learn in Harvard, and he earned a PhD in English literature in Harvard, and they said, what did you learn from the 4 years? However many thousands of dollars of education. He said he learned that. And of course, he learned a tremendous, but the takeaway that he took was that life is complex and human beings are complex. And that's something for us to consider, that for us to think about how we could foster constructive dialogues, acceptance towards those with different viewpoints. We need to sustain an environment conducive to lively discussions, to critical thinking, to innovative ideas, to be willing to hear creative perspectives. And this does stand in contrast to what cancel culture often does, which is oversimplifying, not recognizing the complexity, focusing maybe solely on one remark, on one action that could have taken place many, many years ago, and penalizing anyone who comes to their defense as well. So this idea of complexity is something that F. Scott Fitzgerald, the novelist, he said that, quote, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposite ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. The concept of holding two ideas at the same time, the truth and peace, individual and community. Our striving for peace, but also we need to fight for our self-defense. There's so many different dialectics where we have to hold two different values at the same time. Rabbi Norman Lamb suggests a beautiful idea about the Korech in his Haggadah, the royal table, what's Korech? Right, that's the original Mr. Sandwich. Who is the one who ate the Dr. Sandwich? We have here Dr. Sandwich on Olympic. But the original Dr. Sandwich was Hillel, who said that the way to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah is together with the maror. The rabbis all disagreed with Hillel. They said, what are you talking about? That's crazy. That's outrageous. Why? Because the matzah represents freedom. That itself is a complex food. It has different dimensions, but it really represents freedom, ultimately, and the quick nature of the freedom. And maror is the slavery. So the rabbi said that you can't even fulfill the mitzvah of matzah if you eat it together with maror. And you have to eat them separately. And Hillel said no, that the way to fulfill the mitzvah is dafka, precisely to have the matzah and maror together. And Rabbi Lamb explains, why did Hillel say that? And that's of course what we do with the Seder. We have the matzah, then we have the maror. But then to remember Hillel, we have the matzah and the maror together in a sandwich. And Rabbi Lamb explains that Korach symbolizes the importance of considering all competing values, and that for any moral or ethical problem, we need to consider all values both before and after making the decision, because any one value taken to the extreme can be corrupted. So even if we must choose one over the other, we need to preserve in our mind the legitimacy of the opposite value. He says, quote, we need a dialectic of virtues, a harmonization of competing goods. Freedom and responsibility. Love and morality, right? It's the love of every single human being, even a sinner. But not all choices are equal. Patience and toughness in the education of our children and students. And a young lady who's just hired for her first position in teaching, she asked me, "What do you have any advice, Rabbi?" And I did teach in high school many years ago. I said, be firm but friendly. And I saw that she was somebody who was very, very friendly and, you know, and nice and kind. And I said, maybe you also have to make sure that you're also firm. Firm also. But firm and friendly, right? It's patience and toughness, discipline and independent thinking. And so you have these, it's different values. And truth and peace, we've spoken about that, right? That we strive to be people of truth, but also we want to be tolerant and inclusive and accepting. And we don't want to be brutally honest if it's going to hurt somebody's feelings. And so Korach is this notion of holding on to competing values at the same time, because Korach is the matzah, which is freedom, and the maror, which is slavery, and that to appreciate freedom, you have to realize where you came from. And that things weren't always so good. And that also when you think about the tough times, right, to also, to also always maintain hope. You know, so each one kind of sheds light on the other. You understand the tough times through the freedom, and you understand the freedom through the tough times. And so Korach is really paradigmatic of Hillel's life and legacy. This is the way Hillel was, right, when he debated Shammai, right? This is when the person came to Hillel and said, "Tell me all of Torah. Tell me all of Torah." Standing on one foot, Shammai said, "Get out of here." And Hillel said, "What is hateful to you, do not do unto your neighbor." And the rest is commentary. And we'll come back to that teaching of Hillel. But Hillel represented through word and example this notion of holding on to competing values, presenting his own position while respecting the position of Shammai. And that ultimately, I think, is kind of a lasting lesson to take with us here in terms of how Jewish values helps us navigate the culture wars, is that things are complex and nuanced and have different dimensions. And to respect that another person could have a different perspective than you, and that's okay. Give the benefit of the doubt, forgiveness, and growth. That was in the first dimension. And then in terms of respectful disagreement, in terms of what we say, listening to others, the personal interaction, but also the keeping things positive. There's presenting and elevating yourself as opposed to, right, the blossoming staff, as opposed to destroying the other. And I think if we hold on to that complexity and we keep on to the idea of nuances, you know, I think that'll just make our conversations better, more productive, and make our community, it'll elevate our community and also our world. I'm reminded of one other thing about Rav Amital. When Ambassador Yehuda Avner was in our community, visited our community, and he was an advisor to a number of prime ministers, and he wrote the book, The Prime Ministers. So when I told him that I studied in Gush, he told me that he was asked by Rabin to be an advisor to Rav Amital. Because Rav Amital was appointed as a minister without portfolio for a period of time in the government. And Ambassador Avner shared with me over a lunch that we had together, which I'll always remember, and he was a magnificent human being. Remember when Ambassador Avner visited our community, he said that once Rav Amital gave a speech to a group of religious Zionists in the Knesset, and he said to them, "Atem lo mevinim et hanuansim." You don't understand that there are nuances and complexity and there's different perspectives. That was something Rav Amital taught us, Rav Lichtenstein as well, in terms of life being complex. And I think if we carry forward that notion of complexity, that there's competing values, that there's different perspectives, and that to judge others favorably, because you might not understand everything about that person. You might not understand the whole context. We might not understand, you know, things perfectly. We don't necessarily hold the truth. That there is a place for diversity, and that's why the Migdal Bavel was wrong, and why it was a sin, but rather it's unity with diversity. Hopefully we can elevate ourselves, our community, and the world as well. Thank you so much. Any questions or comments or thoughts? Yeah, go ahead, Jerry. Everyone was kind of quiet. You notice I was steamrolling ahead. But really, that's the conclusion, is I want to hear your opinion. Yes, Jerry.
It's a great way of going forward, but only within a narrow group of people. I mean, we're not going to have that meeting with Hamas and take that point of view and have anything change. But with people closer to us or differing to us, we can.
Phenomenal point, that there's some people who they're... It's a whole different way of life, and they're enemies of the Jewish people, and you're not going to be able to have any discussion with them. That's right. So that's a great point, that it's really with people who are maybe closer to you in thought. And the truth is, a good percentage. Yeah, that's in a certain sense. You have you may be like the 10% that is in your camp. You have the 10% that for sure are going to be opposed to you. There's always a big middle where you can do a lot of good. How can we make a difference?
We will have 10,000 people outside the room. They will not let you enter.
Right. And because one thing we didn't get into, the whole thing about, of course, Israel. Israel is always on our minds, and the way people talk about the way people talk about Israel. So how do you deal with those situations? Look, I think it gets into what Jerry was saying. Yeah, you have the people you're not going to convince, but then you have a large middle where hopefully you can have dialogue and you can make some ground. I think it's important for us to be strong in our beliefs, in our convictions of the cause of Israel and why the war is just, etc. And we can't save. I think we can't save the world. Reminds me of the boy who thrown like the starfish back into the ocean. Someone said, you can't, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of starfish. You can't possibly save them all. And the boy took one and threw it in, and he said, for that starfish, I made his life better. So we just, one table at a time, one conversation at a time. We can't save the world. Lo alecham l'chalek mor. We can't achieve everything, but also we can't, we can't withdraw from the battle altogether. So Israel, of course, is something that a lot of the issues we spoke about relate to in terms of people, even Jews, not appreciating the threats that Israel faces, right? Not appreciating that the enemies around Israel want to destroy Israel. And look at what happened on October 7th, just that dark, dark, horrible day. And so people don't seem to recognize it or appreciate it. And maybe not. They're not open in hearing another perspective. Yeah. Thank you, Daniel, for raising that.
What was the nature of the racial slur that this kid said? And what was the context?
Good question. I don't know. I don't remember.
Because it makes a great deal of difference who said it